The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Hello, this is Sonia Usach-Kuhn. I am about to read to you Meat That Grows on Trees by Carolyn M. Yochim. Haley had a degree in business management and a talent for witchcraft, the perfect combination to start her own company, if she could come up with the right idea. Most of her best ideas had already been taken. Enchanting the calories out of desserts, or trees with blood instead of sap to supply blood banks. Magic had been around for decades now, and all the most profitable ideas were taken. Marcel had picked up her half of the rent this month, but he made it perfectly clear it was a one-time deal. If she didn't think of something soon, she'd have to go back to living with her parents. She went to the kitchen to grab lunch, and Marcel was in there eating an FLT sandwich, fake bacon, lettuce, and tomato. He poked at a strip of faux meat that was sticking out from the edge of the bread, and it crumbled onto his plate. Just like Mom used to make, right? Haley teased. I don't know whose idea it was to use spells to make talking animals, but I really wish they hadn't done it. He shook his head sadly. Any animal that had enough brains to support a talking spell, anything that could even theoretically talk, was now banned for human consumption. Unethical to eat another sentient species, even if it happened not to be a talker. The official law was that you couldn't eat any animal with a brain that weighed more than 10 grams. My mom never made a BLT, though. Tacos, on the other hand, she made delicious tacos de seso. Seso? Brains. I know it sounds weird, but they have this creamy texture. He stopped. Well, those were mostly banned even before magic came into the picture. Mad cow disease and all that. Haley made herself a sandwich and tried not to look disgusted at the thought of eating brains. Meat substitutes aren't so bad. Maybe you could make tacos de seso with some kind of tofu. He laughed. Yeah, I bet it will be as good as this fake bacon stuff. And suddenly she had her idea. She would start a company that grew ethical meats. She'd already learned how to make blood trees at college in her medical magics class. It'd take a little tinkering, but she was sure she could make something that was closer to real meat than anything on the market. Her first attempt at growing meat on trees was a miserable failure. She enchanted a blood tree to grow small chunks of bacon, but exposed to open air, the meat had died before it was ready to harvest. Globs of the stuff disintegrated into slime that coated their balcony and smelled so bad, she called in a professional cleaning sorcerer to get rid of it all. She refined her technique. She coaxed the tree into producing a hard outer shell to protect the meat. This batch got far enough that she was able to crack the egg-like fruits open and cook the goo inside. It was edible, but the texture was all wrong. Muscles needed to move, so the hard shell would have to go. She went through many iterations, perfecting variations on her tree to grow steaks and roasts, pork and lamb and beef, and eventually something that was a better approximation of bacon than any of the meatless substitutes currently on the market. She gathered investors and bought a grove of trees outside the city limits. She formed a company called Tree Meats and applied for approval to sell her plant-based meat. All she had to do was pass inspections, and she was set. Marcel came to visit the orchard with tacos de camarones from the local taco truck. Shrimp, of course, had minuscule brains and were fair game as a taco filling. It reminded her about Marcel's beloved but disgusting-sounding tacos de seso. "How goes the meat tree business?" Marcel asked, handing her a couple of tacos. "Well, the tiny muscle twitches on the pot roast trees have gotten strong enough to sometimes make the branches thrash around, which isn't what I expected. But calming spells seem to be keeping it under control." She took a bite of her taco. Marcel had been amazing, helping her find investors and letting the rent slide another month. Maybe she could get him those tacos he used to like so much. Well, she couldn't grow full-sized cow brains, of course, but maybe she could create a substitute that would meet the FDA standards. Marcel left to go back to work, and she enchanted a tree in the corner of the orchard. Tiny white blossoms morphed into spherical brains, each the size of a blueberry, hanging from the branches by delicate stems. She went to tend the other trees, noting with satisfaction that the pot roast trees were swaying calmly instead of thrashing. The calming spell was working. As she was leaving the orchard, she noticed that one branch of the brain tree was covered in some kind of thread-like white fungus. She removed the branch and sealed it in a Ziploc bag and brought it home to study. If it was something serious, she'd have to get rid of the brain tree before the FDA inspection, which meant it wouldn't get approved, and Marcel would have to wait a long time to get his tacos de seso. She sat on the couch and studied the white threads, which seemed to be growing out of the brain fruits. She tried a few cleaning spells on the branch and eventually managed to get the threads to disappear. She was unprepared for how quickly the thread had spread. The next morning, her entire orchard was covered in the white thread, a massive net that hung across all the branches, as though giant spiders had decided to weave their webs and connect all the blood trees. She tried to pull away a section of the web from one of the pot roast trees, and the muscular branches thrashed and twitched. Something had gone horribly wrong, and all because she had to try to make a brain tree for Marcel. She tried all day to clear the webs away, by hand and with magic, but each time the trees thrashed and flailed. At some point, she narrowly missed being hit in the head by a thick branch, and she retreated to the apartment. It was a disaster. The grove was scheduled for inspection tomorrow, and there was no way she'd pass. She went to the inspection anyway, hoping that the thread would disappear as magically as it had arrived. But if anything, there was more white thread on the trees. The inspector came, took one look at the brain tree, and declared her orchard a protected species because it had a brain of greater than 10 grams. "It doesn't," Haley protested. She had been very careful to keep the brain small, 3 or 4 grams at most. "The brains are all connected by the thread," the inspector said. "I'm sure it can take a talking spell." She hung her head. The inspector left. She had squandered her investors' money and had nothing to show for it, not even tacos for Marcel. She sat at the edge of the orchard and watched the trees with their swaying branches and twitching spheres of meat fruit. Maybe the inspector was wrong. Maybe it wouldn't take a talking spell. It wasn't a good idea to mess with a protected species, but Haley felt like she had to know. She cast the talking spell. "If you can understand me, I'm sorry. I was trying to grow meat on trees, and it got a little out of hand. It would have been a great business, but it never passed inspection." To her surprise, the orchard answered, "Make us a partner in tree meats, and we'll see what we can do."
My name is Joe Campo. I'm reading Erroneous Conclusions by Evergreen Lee. The villagers each brought in a bucket or a box and filled their container with her phosphorescent green eggs. They avoided looking at DE3DR, or Deidre, as she preferred to be called. She followed them out of the lab, her human-like brow furrowed to display confusion. In the town square, a bonfire burned. They threw the eggs into the fire, a handful at a time. Some were small, almost like chicken eggs, while others were as large as watermelons. When they splattered open, their guts displayed a mix of green goo and metal. Fed the right diet of biomass and minerals, each would have grown up to be a unique genetic individual, with a mixture of human and robotic parts. They were her life's work. Better than just a human brain and a metal body like her, they would have been true cyborgs. But now, the humans destroyed them and snuffed out their potential. "Why?" Deidre's voice cracked as she cried out. The murderers ignored her, intent on their destruction. Some even smiled, as if they enjoyed it. Only one human abstained, with arms crossed and a frown on his face. Her boss, Kevin. She strode to him and clutched his arm as if it were a life preserver. "Why?" Kevin's voice sounded resigned. "They think this will keep bitter plague from coming here. They think the cyborg tissue, since it is derived from human cells, can act as a carrier, just as children do. Human children were dormant carriers, able to infect, but with no symptoms until puberty. Then, bam! 80% mortality, just like everyone else. But we've studied it. We know that's not true. The virus requires an endocrine system. I tried to tell them, but they don't believe me. They think I've gone soft. They won't even look at the science." He shook his head. "Not only that, but they've decided cyborgs created the plague in the first place." "Why would we do that?" He laughed, a bitter sound, "to wipe us humans out." "But cyborgs, whether first generation like her or a new model, like the ones being destroyed, couldn't harm humans. It was in their code and embedded in their DNA. They couldn't even get angry or jealous. That was why they didn't have an endocrine system. No puberty, no hormonal desires." He squeezed her hand. "Don't worry. You're safe, since you have an adult brain and no other human cells. They can't claim you might be a carrier. Her imitation stomach clenched as she watched the last of her eggs destroyed. The villagers added larger logs to the fire, and the flames roared upward. Screams, shrill and terrified, came from the direction of the cyborg dormitories. Deirdre gasped. Not the children, too! She started to rush forward to try and stop them, but Kevin grabbed her, and she couldn't fight him. It was part of her programming. He pulled her away from the other villagers. The children couldn't fight either, only scream and cry as they were carried or pulled to the fire. Sorrow, fear, pain, all of those were still included in their physiology. Artificial tears streamed down her face as her chest heaved. Her mechanical heart throbbed so hard she thought it might burst, even though she knew it couldn't. Why, she screamed, they are innocent. Most of the humans ignored her, though a few glared, faces full of hatred and fear. She shrank back into Kevin, and he wrapped his arms around her protectively. I'm sorry I couldn't stop it, but I promise I won't let them hurt you. Religious leaders were still undecided about whether or not cyborgs had souls, but Deirdre thought she must, because a piece of hers died with each small body tossed into the flames. This won't stop the plague, she whispered. And now there won't be anyone left to take care of the survivors. Not here. It had been the whole purpose of her farm and all the others like it, to grow enough cyborgs to keep human civilization from collapsing in the massive die-off that would occur as the plague spread. She'd crunched the numbers herself and knew it was their only hope. No one had been successful in preventing the virus from spreading, and there was no cure or vaccine that had worked. Only her new cyborgs could be created quickly and cheaply enough to meet the demand that would be needed if the plague hit their colony. Not just here. Cyborgs are being destroyed everywhere. She shuddered, imagining the same horrific scene being played out across the galaxy. There would be no one to take care of the sick and increase their chances of living. No one to force them to eat or to keep them clean. No one to keep searching for a cure. The humans had doomed themselves. And Kevin. He would most likely die as well, even if she took the best care of him. His arms tightened as if he could read her thoughts. If they wanted to eliminate the risk, they should have killed the human children, not mine. Kill them all, and there would be no one to carry the virus undetected. Quarantine the infected survivors. And once the virus is eradicated, children can be born safely again. Kill children? Kevin sounded shocked by the idea. Who would do that?
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading The Swindled Selkie by A.C. Spahn. The dark-haired woman hugged herself as the boat creaked in the sea breeze. I just don't know who I can trust anymore, she sobbed. One of them took it, but I don't know which. I never thought this would happen if I tried to work a human job. Kara Watt, paranormal investigator, nodded sympathetically while trying to keep her balance on the rocking deck. How long has your seal skin been missing, Taisha? I keep it in a chest by the life preservers. I like to wear it twice a day to swim, at high tide. Last time I saw it was yesterday evening, around 7. Then this morning, around 6, I went to put it on, and it was gone. Could it have been a random break-in? Crimes against paranormals have been common lately. Taisha swallowed. No. Jerome and Xavier are the only people who have access to the boat. They're the only ones who could have stolen it. Any idea why? Both women turned to look at the speaker. Detective Derek Faraday stood on the dock beside the boat, notepad in hand. Taisha bit her lip. The three of us have worked together for years. Jerome owns the boat and Xavier drives it. I'm the guide for the tours. Bay cruises mostly, but sometimes we take people on deep-sea fishing trips. Lately, Jerome and Xavier have been, fighting over me. You mean romantically? Asked Kara. Yes, they've both asked me out, even proposed. And whenever I put on my seal skin to go to sea, they both look worried, like they're afraid I won't come back. Taisha closed her eyes. Maybe I shouldn't have. I think one of them stole my seal skin to keep me on shore. It's probably deep in the bottom of the ocean by now. Not necessarily, said Derek, crouching to peer into the boat's cockpit. How full is the gas supposed to be? We always fill it up when we dock for the night. The meter says it's not quite full, but whoever ran the gas down didn't go far. I'd say your thief took the boat out last night to hide your other skin in the water, but couldn't get out of the bay. Your second body can't be too far away. Taisha's face brightened, as did Kara's. Detective Faraday gave the PI a quizzical look. What? You rattled all of that off without a hitch. Are you finally getting comfortable with the paranormal? He winked at her. More each day. The three headed below deck to where two men in blue Watson Ridge sailing polos stood on opposite sides of the room. Detective Faraday glared at them. Start talking, gentlemen. Where is the missing sealskin? The one whose T-shirt labeled him Xavier spoke first. I can prove it wasn't me. We docked around 10 last night, and I went straight home. My neighbor saw me come in. Well, said the other man, Jerome, I left right away, too, and grabbed a beer with a friend. He can tell you where I was. And Xavier stayed later than me, so he had more opportunity. I only stayed because you have no idea how to secure the lines and moor the boat. I pay you to do those things so I don't have to. Not enough. It's not my fault business has been slow lately. Gentlemen, said Detective Faraday in a warning tone. Both quieted. One of them is lying, Taisha said. Either could have taken the boat out alone during the night. Yes, said Kara, and I know which one it is. Kara pointed at Jerome. He's the one who took the boat out last night and hid the sealskin. Jerome's face reddened. I have an alibi. Whoever stole the sealskin did it at night, when it would have been low tide, the worst time to take out a deep-sea boat like this one. That's why you couldn't get out of the bay. Your pilot would have known better than to try to sail in shallow water, but you don't seem to know much about boating. I'll bet if we talk to your friend, your alibi will fall apart. Jerome's eyes widened. He turned desperately to Taisha. I only wanted to make you consider my proposal. Please, it was all for love. Taisha recoiled. Get him away from me. As Detective Faraday led Jerome up on deck, Xavier took Taisha's hands. He wouldn't have thrown your skin away forever. Even Jerome isn't that selfish. It's probably tied to one of the buoys around the bay. There are hundreds of those. I'll help you find it. If we have to check every buoy out there, we'll get your true self back. Thank you, Xavier. Kara made a discreet exit as the two embraced.
I'm Joe Pinella. Up next is They Fell Like Comets by Hans Hergau. It's a sin to kill a lightning bug. Its guts will not turn a wiffle ball bat into a lightsaber. Smearing its green butt on your face will not make you a fairy. We knew it was wrong in our hearts, but we did it anyway. That summer, they paid us $10 a jar to catch fireflies. We went out in the dusk armed with nets and small hands. The fireflies blinked like the stars overhead. We caught whole constellations. We cut a swath through their Milky Way. We filled mason jars with a million tiny stars, each a beacon of light to the universe. A firefly can only fly so high before it comes back down. We were patient, waiting till they fell like comets. The jars blinked in a dulsome unison. We were impervious to their pleas. Each jar went in the freezer, then to the fire department where we collected our shekels, and spent them at Kmart on G.I. Joes and Transformers. I hid Snake Eyes in the linen department so I could get him the next week. $10 was just too much money for a boy growing up in the South to ignore. We went to sleep each night with the smell of fireflies in our nostrils, that high, fishy smell, as distinctive as a honeysuckle. They told us the scientists at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory wanted the lightning bugs for an experiment. They never told us what for. It was as secret as the Manhattan Project. They had harnessed the atom. What more could they want? We imagined the energy of a million tiny tails squeezed out like orange juice concentrate. That winter, we watched as the space shuttle raced to the stars, fueled, we were certain, by our fireflies. The rocket burned like a million tiny suns. The shuttle rose into the blue Florida sky. It blinked once. We watched from the school auditorium, sharing in the collective guilt and horror. They never again asked us to collect lightning bugs, and if they had, we would not have supplied them. We watched the fireflies in the summer sky blinking in unison, calling out to each other from across the darkness, silent as the stars in flight.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is the shortest sci-fi story ever by Seth Chambers. For sale, spacesuit, small leak, worn once, cheap. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.